You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Scott Shepherd, and I am the host of the City's First podcast. We focus on urbanism, decarbonization, as well as all forms of mobility and digitalization. I'm here today with Lucas Neckerman, who is the Chief Operating Officer of Split and a strategic advisor and consultant to all forms of mobility, as well as different strategic entities. I want to welcome Lucas here today. We're going to be talking about many different topics in the ecosystem, specifically related to super apps, mobility as a service, as well as digital connectivity and artificial intelligence. So, Lucas, welcome to our podcast. It's real a pleasure to have you. This is our second episode, and we're really excited to kind of do a little bit of a deep dive into where we're at in 2022 in this disruptive market.
Great to be here, Scott. Absolutely. It is a crazy time in the world of mobility and data and cities and all of these things as we come out of a pandemic and are reimagining the world around us a little bit and hopefully taking some of the learnings that we've gathered over the last 2 years to reevaluate again how we want to live and move around our cities.
Taking stock is the word, this new world that we're in right now. So with that, we're just going to jump into the first question here, the first topic, and let's get started. So kind of a topic I know that's a bit near and dear to your heart, and you have a real significant experience for, you know, several decades now, is around the automotive industry and OEMs. And I would like to talk about kind of a trend that we've seen pre, during, and even now post-COVID, which is this kind of strategic shift in the automakers in the shared mobility ecosystem, whether it's mobility as a service, on-demand mobility, micromobility, and other offers. So just to kind of get your quick take and crystal ball, what do you think is next? What's the power play for OEMs and shared mobility, given their kind of shift away from this domain, let's say starting in 2019?
So it took the automakers quite a while to even figure out what mobility as a term meant. And they threw a lot of things into the term mobility, and I think that's fair. I called it the three zeros. You will remember some 8 years ago, zero emissions, zero accidents, zero ownership. So electrification, autonomous, and shared mobility. And perhaps just very quickly, we go through those. Zero emissions, look, the ship has sailed. It's crystal clear, and they're making decent progress, the legacy automakers, but only after they got a swift kick in the hindsight from some new entrants. You know, the Tesla market cap is higher than the next 9 or 10 other OEMs. And there are certain reasons for that. Tesla's much more than a car company, as we well know. You know, some 40% of new vehicles this quarter are going to be electrified in Europe. And if you had told somebody that 5 years ago, they would have said you were crazy. And in fact, they did. They told you or me,
yes,
those of us who anticipated.
I saw your post yesterday.
That, yeah, exactly. It must be outrageous. So that's the one point. The second is autonomous. OEMs have a sadly inherent disincentive to promote autonomous vehicles for two reasons. One is, so much downstream revenue is, you know, made from fixing cars, spare parts, repairs. Now, not to be a cynic here, but at the very least, they need to reevaluate what happens when cars crash less. They need to preserve the dealership network that fixes those vehicles.
Right.
But even more so, and this gets us then into the shared piece, fully autonomous vehicles, so level four and up, are more likely to be shared, right? If you're getting used to sitting in the back of a vehicle, as perhaps you already do through ride pooling or ride hailing, you know, you don't care anymore what's on the front of the vehicle, and you probably also don't care if there are two or three other people in the vehicle with you. So that decreases the overall need for you know, cars to be sold. So again, that takes us to shared mobility. And here, broadly speaking, OEMs have not succeeded. I mean, kudos to Freenow for achieving what it has. It's a very good, credible shared mobility play in Europe. But it's still nowhere close to a Grab or a Cream or an Uber. Others, Stellantis, yes, the mobility operations are growing. Clearly lacks still a little bit of definition. And everybody else, Toyota, Ford, GM, I mean, they've failed miserably and exited, broadly speaking, the shared mobility space, because it's not in their core expertise. Shared mobility takes operational excellence, and it takes knowing the customer, knowing and understanding the end customer. OEMs are not B2C companies.
Right.
OEMs historically are B2B companies. Mm-hmm. They sell to leasing companies. They sell to financing companies. They sell to a dealer network who then has the contact to the end customer. But the OEM itself doesn't really have enough knowledge about its end customer to serve him or her well. And that's one of the reasons they've failed. And the other reason is, of course, again, they don't have an inherent interest in making shared mobility work other than to sell vehicles. That is, as long as they keep defining themselves as an automaker. And frankly, that's what their shareholders are expecting of them. And the reason for that is simple. Shared mobility competes in a space that is subsidized. Right?
Indeed.
Public transport is a heavily subsidized industry. So if all of a sudden you're, whether it's car sharing or bike sharing or scooters or ride hailing, whatever it is, first of all, there's a startup cost, which is fairly high and means that you're going to be carrying losses for at least the first couple of years. Second of all, even at a steady state, this is not going to give you the same return as, you know, selling big hunks of steel and glass. And that's what the shareholders expect. And that means that there's an inherent disincentive for OEMs and a disconnect as well for OEMs to do well with shared mobility.
Yeah. And that was that kind of tipping point, I would say, around 2018, or that come to Jesus moment 2019, where we saw this disinvestment even before COVID, and then just accelerated during the pandemic. And that's where we're at today. That's where we're at right now. So those are really good points.
Yeah.
Well said. So the next question, I think, is a little bit closer to what you're focused on right now at Split, which is super apps. And you mentioned a few. So basically, how can super apps help to supercharge public transport? So obviously, super apps have many different use cases, from consumer goods, retail, as well as personal mobility, private mobility, but fitting in public transport into this ecosystem, what is the potential for super apps to help supercharge public transport in this post-COVID city, the post-COVID world?
Right. Well, the key thing that a super app can do for the end user is to make their lives easier, right? Especially if you're traveling cross-border. So let's assume I go to Lisbon or Barcelona or Munich. All right. Now, I'm very familiar with Munich, but still, it's quite a challenge maneuvering their tickets. Now, you're standing at the airport. You've got a single ticket. You've got a short ride ticket. You've got a strike ticket. You've got a day ticket. You've got a ticket for the inner city. You've got a ticket for the outer city. You've got a ticket to and from the airport. And each of these, of course, varies by age, or if I'm a student, or if I'm a senior. Then on top of that, there are six zones of travel, and the cost of the ticket depends on how many zones I travel. This is one of the absurdities of public transport, that we've created this ridiculous barrier to entry This is just to get onto a tube, a subway from the airport. And that's a challenge for mobility as a service. It's a challenge for public transport operators, very, very generally speaking, but it's a challenge that super apps could make go away. Now, the Munich example, that's one city, one country for one day.
Right. Yeah.
Now, what if I travel quite a bit? For every city, I'm not going to learn the entire fare structure or the ticketing structure in public transport. And I'm not going to download a separate app every time I want to use a scooter or a bicycle or car sharing or ride hailing, right? So the advantage of a super app, and this could be a mobility as a service app that actually covers multiple cities, which is a separate story.
It's a separate
app. But it could also be be a fintech brand. It could be a bank app. It could be a travel app. It could be exactly that same app that you used to book the flight ticket or to book your hotel to get to Munich or Lisbon or Barcelona. Now, within the super app, they know who you are, right? That means that they can pre-populate most of the fields in an online order or an online ticket. Second, they have your payment details. No entering credit card details every single time that you want to, you know, take a ride. Third, they're fully integrated. Again, no new logins, no new apps to use, no
linking,
you know, code that gets sent to my phone, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
Fourthly, they bring the users. Now, when we talk about super apps, certainly from a split perspective, we're talking about apps that have a billion or more users. WeChat, Alipay, these are apps that have 500 million or more daily users, not downloads or monthly active users, daily users, right? That's simply awesome. You know, you can't copy. There's not a single mobility as a service app. There's not a single other single use app out there that can copy that model. And that means that they come with an inherent demand platform. And that demand platform means, hey, every supply partner should want to interact with that. They should want to get in into Alipay or Grab or WeChat or any other super app, right? My favorite example of this is Amazon. I mean, how many retail apps do you actually still have on your phone?
None. not for me. Yeah.
Exactly. You've got one. Because because Amazon has mastered the long tail, right? You can find pretty much anything on the, if you have an obscure hobby and you need a spare part for that hobby,
you're just gonna go to Amazon.
Your first point of reference, it's gonna go on Amazon, of course. Right. And it's the same thing. I'm not going to Lisbon every day, I'm not going to Munich every day. I might go, you know, once every few months, maybe only once a year. So I'm not going to get a separate app for each of those things, right? So this is the long tail. As long as I'm integrating all of these different things into one app that already has all of my information, all of my login details, payment details, and all of that, then why wouldn't I use that app?
So that's true. Just to kind of add to that, I know we have another question, but where do you see the integration of public transport in that kind of user flow or user journey, so that it kind of completes that door-to-door experience, if that's the preference of the consumer to maybe not use private mobility, or at least use that as one leg of their journey?
Yeah. I mean, some of the apps that we use for journey planning, you know, the City Mappers, the Apple Maps, the Google Maps, the Moovits, they're fantastic. They will tell me how to get from A to B, no question about it, and they're amazing at what they do, but that's only half the battle, right? Knowing how I get from A to B is only half the battle. If I still have the hurdle and I have to add on an extra 12 minutes because I'm standing in front of a ticket machine in order to get a paper ticket to you know, get a, then all of the journey planning in the world makes no sense to me. So it's about simplifying the and lowering the hurdle of use that public transport has inexplicably really put onto itself.
They have not done themselves favor.
You know, the tech world, the tech world comes from how many clicks to payment or how many clicks to completion, right? Yeah. And public transport is, I don't know, 20, 30 clicks, whereas most things you can buy with, you know, four to six clicks, right? Or you can set up an account. So we need to lower the hurdle to get more people into public transport. I think that's you and I, we both share that goal. We want to get
that's an people enabler.
Into You're, active is, modes of active modes of transport. Get people out of privately owned vehicles or single occupancy vehicles. And anything that we can do to make that happen by, you know, putting it all in one app and reducing that hurdle to use, well, you know, bingo.
Yeah. It's an enabler for nudging and modal shift. Absolutely. Yeah. Very good. Okay. So the next question, I just want to talk about an article I just shared with you. Actually, it was just on CityLab. We just chatted about this before the call here. It's really interesting. And it leads to kind of just the, let's say, you know, what we call in the United States, the right of way or the real estate, the public domain of sidewalks and streets and how the built environment for cities are starting to transform, maybe not necessarily become privatized, but becoming seen as a potential asset that is a opportunity. And this comes back to how we view deliveries and parking and how we've subsidized and incentivized the public space and curbs in the domain of private cars and automobiles. So I guess the question though is, in this article, which was really interesting, talks about this, is data the new gold and how much can we monetize the curb? Meaning that, is this an opportunity for cities to start actually charging the real cost for curbside parking and as well as deliveries? And what is kind of the right balance of many of the new private sector, let's say venture capital funded startups and venture technology entities that are trying to, you know, capture the space?
So let's start with how much is curb space worth? Obviously, Donald Shoup did, you know, amazing work on this many, many years ago, decades ago. But cities still haven't acted upon that. They don't properly value and put a cost on the curb. In most cities, you or I, we can get a resident or a commercial parking permit for a pittance, $20 a month. I could park a 7 meter long camper van on that space and store my stuff. Maybe I can even rent it out to store other people's stuff. Maybe even I want to make this into my home office. Maybe even I could rent out co-working spaces. You know, I'm paying the city $20 a month rent for valuable real estate. It's absurd. Mm-hmm. The same ground space for a building would cost me hundreds to rent, if not more. So we really don't value parking spaces in our cities sufficiently, and mostly because councils are afraid, right? They're afraid of, you know, shaking things up. They're afraid of the residents and the companies and the businesses around, but they really shouldn't be. Right? Because the councils, they don't have a problem in overcharging car sharing or bike sharing operators. They're the new kids on the block. So mm-hmm. they get a higher cost than the actual resident, in spite of the fact that they're creating a social good. And that social good is removing privately owned vehicles from the street. So, you know, if we can reduce the number of resident parking spots dramatically, then I wouldn't even have a problem with pickup and drop off fees for ride hailing. If I have, you know, those on every block, if I can have, you know, car sharing spots, if I can have bike sharing and scooter sharing spots every block or every other block, because getting back to what you were saying earlier, Scott, using the word nudge, you know, it pushes, it gently nudges residents into scooters, bikes, or other shared modes of transport. And the way to do that is to price those spots the right way. Now, your other question was, who's responsible for that? Is it is it private companies or is it cities? Well, the reason I gave that example earlier on, you know, renting out a camper van is that would be the equivalent of me renting the space from the city and then remarketing it for its proper value. If the city is undervaluing an asset that it has, then, hey, guess what? Private enterprise can come in and value that asset for what it's worth.
Price it accordingly if they're going to come in. Right, right. Yeah, yeah. So that's a good way to put it. Or they could potentially, the opportunities, they could be an enabler to actually, deliver on many cities and municipalities' transportation policies and goals. If they are having trouble asserting that domain themselves, even though, all of the common knowledge and information is out, like you mentioned, Donald Troup's book, The High Cost of Free Parking, as well as others, if basically cities can seek partners that can help price these structures accordingly, and then generate a return that strikes that balance for a proper distribution and nudging of the actual public space, then that is quite an interesting opportunity. There are two different arguments that perhaps maybe private sector vendors should not be too much in charge of that because they might not have public transportation policy in their best interest. But I think it's yet to be seen. I think there's a lot of gray area. I certainly am not of any school of thought personally. I think that there's enough room for innovation to try to kind of capture this opportunity of, let's say, not monetizing the curb, but properly pricing the curb so that's better balanced with, societal gain and societal goals. So I think that's kind of where we're landing on that one. The next question I just wanted to kind of chat about really quickly is around just kind of general, I would say, artificial intelligence and machine learning is coming up a lot lately with a lot of interesting use cases, a lot of hype. Some use cases are more interesting than others. Certainly some of the stuff that we're working on, my company AssistaB is quite interesting in the field of public transport. But I wanted to get your take on this in terms of how can AI machine learning help us to readjust mobility for the post-COVID city? This is more of a blanket question, but where do you see some of these, let's say, opportunities or continuing this theme of nudging, where having better data-driven insights can help us strike a more sustainable, equitable, resilient balance in, let's say, the mobility world as we're trying to kind of readjust to this new normal?
Okay. Let's start with the notion that we have data. We have mountains of data. Public transport operators have decades of data. And certainly in the last few years, because many of them have been recording, through Wi-Fi, how users are moving through the city, and more data than they know what to do with.
Indeed.
And that gets to, the key competence of an AI or ML system, where I put a task on that and say, listen, wade through this data, tell me, A, how can I better tailor my public-private transport system, right? For me, public transport is anything that moves the public. So I can include ride-hailing in that, I can include car sharing in that, scooter sharing, bike sharing, whatever. I can include all of that into it as long as it's not the privately owned single occupancy car. So if my aim is to improve that network of public and private mobility operators, then I need to start with the data where and when are people and goods moving through our city. And no city will have enough human resources to wade through that data. Costs are always being cut, and we'll never be as efficient as having machine learning kind of wade through that data and make recommendations and say, listen, that bus line over there, not enough people are riding it, you can switch that maybe to a ride pooling or an on-demand service. Over there is where you have three different operators operating car share. Maybe you can nudge, maybe you can encourage them to go to that mobility desert over there in that other part of the city where there's just a new development coming up. And these people have a high propensity, a high desire even to live a car-free life, because of their demographics, because of their psychographics, because of the way that they have expressed themselves, maybe even on social media, maybe even through, you know, their LinkedIn, Instagram, or whatever feeds, right? They said, hey, I'd love to be able to live a car-free lifestyle, but I don't have the operators in front of my door. Now, is the city picking up on that? Probably not. Could it pick up on that? Absolutely. If it A, use the data that it already has, and B, starts you know, scanning for additional data points and putting that through an ML system.
Yeah, no, that's great. And it's about supply and demand, and it's about meeting consumer preference and using historical data insights. You know, where is this, the historical travel patterns, multimodality, training your machine learning model, your algorithm, to actually come up with better predictions for these different modal preferences, and then kind of rebalance your digital infrastructure as well as your physical infrastructure. So it's not just operational budgets, but capital budgets and capital investments for future, let's say, bike networks, multimodal mobility hubs, as well as other types of investments that we're seeing in this COVID and post-COVID era, where AI machine learning could help better inform engineers, designers, planners, and others who are really trying to remake our post-COVID city, at least here in Europe and the UK, but certainly North America and globally. And I think that that's really the opportunity, is to understand that real traveler and passenger demand historically, to make better predictions from a multimodal perspective, understand these consumer preferences, and then just make a better decisions upon the data we already have. And the data, like you mentioned, is sitting in silos in GIS systems, it's sitting in ticketing systems, it's sitting everywhere, but it's not actionable. And it doesn't necessarily mean it's actionable from one specific tool, but I think that's the missing link, where this is a really interesting use case or opportunity that I think will take us to more, let's say, smarter investments. Not necessarily in the smart city, because I don't want to use that cliche or term anymore, but the city that's more human-centric, the post-COVID city that is using the best of technology like AI machine learning for more human-centric development and sustainable outcomes, really. So that's something I'm very excited about as well. So our final question here, and then we'll kind of round it off with some closing thoughts, kind of getting back to what you're working on at Split, as well as Super Apps, but it's just in general in the mobility mixes. Let's look at where we're at right now in micromobility, because we're having a really interesting year right now in terms of things happening in Eastern Europe. We have inflation, we have supply chain, all these things converging in 2021, 2022, post-COVID, and how it's impacting micromobility. So if you have a crystal ball, where do you see micromobility, let's say in the next 12 months in 2023? Because we're going through a massive period of disruption right now in kick scooter and bike share specifically.
Three things. One is better infrastructure. The second, linked to better infrastructure, is more use. There's a direct correlation between the safe infrastructure for bike and scooter use and use of those modes within cities. And the third is increased regulation. The simple fact is that cities are still allowing for better or for worse, lots and lots of operators to come into the city, drop off bikes and scooters. I personally have less of a problem with that, but it creates a it creates a discourse that they really should want to avoid. Mm-hmm. Right? There was a whole discussion in here in London with the city coming in, the borough of Westminster coming in and then picking up bikes and scooters off the streets and saying they're polluting our pavements, polluting our sidewalks and things like that. And I keep thinking, well, really, surely the bigger evil must be the cars and delivery vans that are parked on the sidewalks and the pavements and all of the other things. But no, they seem to want to go after the bikes and the scooters.
Yeah.
Either way, there will be more regulation around where the vehicles can be parked. In other words, there will be dedicated yes. bays for the vehicles. Mm-hmm. There will be limitations on how many operators can be in a city. More and more cities are going to, you know, have a permit type system, a licensing type system for scooters and
closed markets.
Shared e-bikes. And thirdly, and I welcome this as well, is that they need to have a data exchange with these operators. A few cities have required this. In other words, they provide the data into the city. Where are the vehicles parked? How are the vehicles being used? So there is going to be more regulation, but that's ultimately going to take us to, I don't know, call it micro mobility 3.0, a world where we'll have the streets, the safe lanes to use and to park electric scooters and bikes, and that will enable and empower people to use them. Finally, and this all, you know, this goes without saying, electrification of shared bikes. We still have cities that have, you know, regular pedal bikes, and that's fine. That attracts maybe 5%, maybe 10% of the population of a city, and I'm not talking about Copenhagen or Amsterdam or any of the very, very bike heavy, mostly flat cities.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the wider population who doesn't want to break a sweat when they go to the office, that has to encounter a few hills on their way to the office or a meeting or the theater or wherever they happen to be going, school or a restaurant, and also enabling longer distances. I think the e-bike just has a wider
radius. And more increased value capture, so I think that you have a much larger pool of potential users and customers with that opportunity if cities were to really kind of align their policies to promote those types of e-bike sharing systems, as well as sharing schemes, whether they're publicly funded or subsidized or operated by the private entities as well too. Those are some really interesting trends. I think thinking about back to micromobility, being much more regulated and controlled, as well as aligned with technology and safety, is another thing too. Just kind of adding to that point, we're seeing some interesting tech vendors out there, kind of, let's say, integrating their technologies, whether it's full stack or kind of off the shelf, into micromobility devices to help align with public safety goals. I think that's a more increasing requirement of these closed permit systems, where the tenders and the RFPs are more stringent and they're requiring more of the operators. So I think that's even another area of interest, but all of this is aligned. These are all positive outcomes. So maybe we'll see fewer scooters, but they'll be used more often. And I think that they'll play a much stronger role in this kind of modal shift theme that we're talking about in the post-COVID world. So I think it's very, very exciting. We're moving away from the Wild West laissez-faire, you know, world, Adam Smith world, to a little bit more of the John Maynard Keynes world of scooter share. Maybe not quite that extreme, but the government is going to take a more, central role. And I think that it'll be really exciting to see where we land, let's say, in the next 12 months. So, yeah, thanks for your thoughts on that. So really quickly, I have a few minutes left just to kind of round out. I just want to get your closing thoughts and where you see, let's say, in terms of back to the theme of shared mobility. So kind of looking at all these different offers, whether it's mobility as a service, on demand, or we call it microtransit North America, as well as micromobility autonomy. What are going to be, let's say, not the losers, but what do you think are going to be the winners in the next 12 to 24 months? What do you think has the most promise based upon what you've seen and heard?
Any city, any operator, any company, startup, legacy, who makes life simple, is going to win. The success of the automobile over the last century has been because we've quite literally paved the way for people taking the key out of their pocket, having the car parked in front of their door, being able to drive wherever they want to go in a direct route, being able to park directly in front of the door of their destination and leaving the car there. It doesn't get simpler than that. Multimodality comes with some inbuilt challenges, and our job, our role, is to remove those challenges, remove the hurdles, and make life simpler for the end user. It's not even necessarily a question of cost. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. It's a question of simplicity, ease of use, and comfort. In many cities, it's already faster to use a bike or a scooter to get from A to B. Heck, it's even easier to use public transport in many cities. But people will still use the car because of the ease of getting into the vehicle and the obvious parking spot that's in front of their destination. And that's just frankly an absurdity we need to do away with. But we do away with it by creating alternatives that are easy to use and make people want to do that. And it takes public and private interaction. It takes public and private partnership. And it takes business models that focus on the user, on the human, and not on the technology.
Yeah. The user first and the technology comes later. So we cannot have solutions looking for problems, but we actually have to identify the problems first. So in your final thoughts, where can the audience find you on social media, as well as all different types of channels?
So my rants come on Twitter at L Neckerman, Neckerman with two N's. Most people can find me certainly on LinkedIn as well. Just find Lucas with a K, Neckerman with two N's. And you can find me on those two channels primarily. I can find some speeches I've done on YouTube and other places, but generally you'll find me.
And I'm sure you'll be speaking soon at upcoming conferences events, so we'll probably see you there as
There's
well.
There's a few planned, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll see you there.
Yeah, exactly, yes. Well, thank you so much, Lucas. It's been a real pleasure for our second episode of the City's First Podcast. We're really excited to get this episode uploaded and shared with everyone on the usual channels, such as Spotify, Apple, Google, YouTube, as well as RSS. So look for this podcast very soon. And thank you very much, everyone. Thanks, Lucas.
Thanks for having me, Scott. Been a great pleasure.
Thank you.